Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 3rd, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santamaria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I do want to thank those who continue to make Talk Nerdy 100% free to download. Well, I guess who continue to make sure that Talk Nerdy can be 100% free to download. I keep, you know, churning through the show with the support of my assistant, Noelle Dilworth, and the incredible editing team that I work with. And of course, that requires financial support. There are a bunch of ways to do that. I do sell ads on the show, but I also depend on my patrons. If you want to pledge your support, you can go to patreon.com/talknerdy to do so, because of course, I pledge to you that I will never charge to be able to listen to Talk Nerdy. This week's top patrons include Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so much for your support. All right, so let's talk about this week's episode. I had the opportunity to chat with Michelle Niehaus. And Michelle is a biologist turned science writer who focuses on conservation and global change. She currently works as a project editor at The Atlantic, where she works with writers on a series called Life Up Close. She's also written for a ton of different outlets like The New Yorker, National Geographic, New York Times Magazine, et cetera, et cetera. She's won a bunch of incredible journalism awards, and she has a new book. It's called Beloved Beasts, Fighting for Life in an Age of Extinction. So without any further ado, shortlisted for the 2020 J. Anthony Lucas Work in Progress Award and one of LitHub's most anticipated books of 2021, the author of Beloved Beasts, Michelle Niehaus. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be here.
So we are going to talk about your new book, Beloved Beasts, Fighting for Life in an Age of Extinction. And I think probably the question that's sort of on the tip of my tongue after digging through is, how did you choose to focus the title? It must have been a hard book to title because it's about so much. It's about people. It's about the conservation movement. It's about the passion and the excitement of the movement and actually its triumphs, but also the places where it's been misguided, its failures. And so I guess what drew you to title it focused on the animals themselves, the beasts?
Well, it's funny because the title came before anything else.
Oh, how fun.
yeah. And the phrase came to me before I started working on the proposal, and titles often change in the process of writing a book, and the subtitle did change significantly and multiple times, but the main title always stayed the same for some reason, and it was kind of a talisman for me through the process, because as you say, the book is about so many different things, and I'm trying to represent a lot of complex history in a reasonably sized book. So for me, the title was important because it spoke to the relationship between the people I was writing about and the species that they wanted to, whose survival they wanted to protect, whose long-term survival they wanted to protect. And while many of them were scientists and had a scientific background, that connection at its heart is emotional. And that was an important thread for me to follow through this history. And so even though the book really of course, animals are present throughout the book, but I follow the life stories of people through the book. I wanted beasts to be in the title because the connection between humans and beasts is so important to the story.
Oh, absolutely. And so, I'm interested, before we dive into the story or the stories, I'm interested in sort of your path. You have been working as a science writer, but also an editor. You're an editor at The Atlantic for many years. You're the co-editor of the Science Writer's Handbook. So this is, how do you write science? This is kind of deep SciComm work,
yes.
It's sort of like in the Beltway SciComm work. And so, I'm interested in your, maybe not your specific logistical path, but your approach and your ethos when it comes to writing science. Do you start with the conception that, like, the human stories are at the center? You know, how do you go about crafting a story?
That's an interesting question. Just a little bit of personal history. I was a unexpected biology major. I went to college thinking I was going to major in English lit, soon discovered that my interest in reading and writing had very little relationship to what you actually did as an English major, which was study literary criticism and produce literary criticism. And meanwhile, I was taking a great introductory biology class. I'd always been a little bit afraid of science. And I thought this is going to make it sound much more organized than it actually was. But I think in the back of my mind, I thought, well, I really like writing. Biology seems really interesting. I'm interested in conservation. Maybe there's a way to learn something in college that I could eventually write about.
Right.
So I think I have, you know, what I'm interested in science, but I don't think I ever really saw myself as a researcher. I always knew I was a little bit more of a generalist, and as I went forward in science, and as I worked for a few years on wildlife research projects after college, I realized that I was at least as interested in the human story of science and the stories of scientists and researchers and how the effect of science on society as I was in the subjects of the science or in the research findings themselves. So for me, it's always, all of those things have always been part of the stew. I haven't moved from one to the other. But I've really, for me, the joy is in connecting all of those things and finding a way to do that for a broader audience.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's such an important side of journalism, of reporting, of writing, of storytelling, is that, you know, we have our sort of idiosyncratic passions, not to say that this book is overly idiosyncratic. It obviously speaks to a lot of people, but we, you know, when people ask us what makes you tick, what do you love, what have you been reading about lately, what are you passionate about, it's sometimes very easy to you know, just, I don't know, have this deluge of like, of, oh my God, this thing, it's been, you know, keeping me up and it's so exciting and blah, blah, blah. But how then do we translate that to others so that they can see what we see or feel what we feel when we dig deep into this information? And it sounds like conservation, this kind of movement to fix, to save, to mitigate, to adjust, to correct the wrongs that the human species have kind of perpetrated on the planet, has been something that you've carried with you even from the time you were a teenager.
Yeah, it's always been interesting to me at some level, varying levels of seriousness. When I was working on those wildlife research projects in the Southwest after college, I was deeply struck by the politics surrounding the species I was working on. And that made me realize that what might to some people seem like an almost antique concern, you know, oh, how did we save species? We figured that out, right? I mean, not, I think people are aware of extinction and biodiversity loss, but they're not maybe aware of conservation as a movement that is still developing, and that is still, you know, active issue that is full of issues that are actively being debated. That experience in the Southwest, you know, eavesdropping in coffee shops and hanging out in meeting rooms and listening to people really passionately argue about these fundamental questions left a deep impression on me and made me, I think when I became a journalist, made me see conservation as a set of very live issues that had a long history. And I just became more and more interested in following that history, which I think a lot of people are familiar with the outlines of it. They know, you know, they know famous names. They know Rachel Carson. They might know Aldo Leopold or John Muir, but but they don't have a sense of it as a story, as a tradition. And that's what I wanted to try to capture in the book.
With still some sort of very interesting, modern, cutting edge introductions and conversations along the way. So it's not just this kind of history of the conservation movement specifically, or to a large extent here in America, but also this, you know, how is this in action today? Like, what are the outcomes today of this longstanding movement? You know, I wanted to bring up kind of maybe before we dive into some of those specific stories, and this might feel a little bit, I don't know, tangential, but whatever, it's my show. This is what came to my mind.
Go for it.
Yeah. Is that a couple years ago now, I had the opportunity to go and speak about science communication in Windhoek in Namibia in Southern Africa to a group. Yeah, it was amazing. And I've been back several times since. Cause it's
Oh, have you?
Yeah. Love Namibia. It's probably my favorite place on the planet. And I was speaking at a conservation hunting conference, and it was about how do we talk about difficult issues with audiences that are coming at it with their own biases. And of course, I came at it with a white Western bias of trophy hunting is bad. You know, I came at it with this bias that only rich white people who are, you know, not very ethically centered want to kill large animals, and doing so is a mark on the planet. And when I left Namibia after talking to most of the local individuals and even some of the indigenous individuals in these areas, and I understood the complex and nuanced nature of trophy hunting, of selling a tag for an old elephant bull, for example, who's been a problematic animal and who has crushed multiple water supplies within a local region, and, you know, selling this tag to a Westerner who pays $250,000, and then that funds an anti-poaching patrol for a year. I think I just came at it not knowing the difference between poaching and hunting, not knowing any of the nuances. And I came away with it from this with this fresh perspective after talking to the boots on the ground of people saying white people who mean well actually affect policy here, and they don't know what it's like because they've never been here and they've never done the legwork.
Yeah.
And this is something that really changed my opinion about conservation in a larger way. It made me stop and say, I think I know. I don't know. I don't know until I've done the work. And what feels right isn't necessarily what is right, because it's always more complicated than it looks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, well, we'll get to Namibia, because I also had a chance to go to Namibia for my book research was equally struck by it. Yeah. And I do tackle trophy hunting in my book and, you know, for many of the same reasons. I agree. Conservation is almost always more complicated than it looks on the surface. It's easy to have global blanket opinions about different conservation issues, and they are almost always wrong, or at least not as universal as they might seem from the outside. I really wanted this history to help communicate that to people. Because I do feel like that's one of the gifts of history. I didn't want to just tell the history for the sake of preserving it, though that is one function of history. I wanted to show how this history, the history of this movement and the history of the mistakes it's made and the accomplishments it's managed to effect, is very relevant to the present day. And in fact, I think it's necessary to understand a lot of those ins and outs in order to make some of the very complicated decisions that we're going to have to make in the coming decades.
Oh, you're so right. And this to divorce the history from the people themselves, like to think of the history of conservation as a natural history movement and not as a movement of people, of opinions, of power, of even colonialism, of racism, is to really do ourselves a disservice and to continue to kind of reinvent the wheel.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you have to look at it as existing within all of those structures that we all exist in and continue to exist in. If it just becomes a procession of heroic individuals who happen to, you know, for whom the stars aligned and they were able to make a difference, then I think it's, you're not representing it accurately. And you're also not pointing the way toward further change. You know, you're, because then the message is, well, you have to be a brilliant icon and very lucky in order to make a difference, when the truth is there's a tradition that people can learn about and be part of and help to expand and evolve. And there are so many possibilities for progress on conservation. And so I hoped that history, by using the historical lens, I hoped to get that across, get that sense of possibility across.
You know, I think that's a good kind of transition point. You mentioned this idea of, like, you'd have to be an icon to have any sort of momentum or to have any sort of power. But of course, even the concept of an icon, even the concept of kind of a mover and shaker within a movement, is a complex one. Some people start with power and utilize that to their advantage. Other people are only icons in hindsight. Mm-hmm. Because of the work that they did. So I'm wondering, where do you think is a good place to start? Like, whose story that maybe we have a misunderstanding about, or an incomplete kind of personal narrative about, is one that you think would be important for us to discuss today on the show?
Well, I'll just say a little bit about how I chose the characters,
because there's so many people, right?
Maybe as I talk, it will become clear where we can go with it, because there are many possibilities. But so I completely agree that the concept of icon is very complicated. And some of the people who I chose to profile are people who we now think of as icons, but were not particularly well known in their lives, or at least were not particularly well known during most of their careers. And very few of them had any sense that what they were doing was going to make a difference. You know, most of them did not go around thinking of themselves as icons whose legacy would survive for generations. They were not working with that kind of certainty or with that kind of self-importance. That said, some of the people I chose are people we know today. I mentioned Rachel Carson. I mentioned Aldo Leopold, who was the founder of the field of wildlife biology. And then some of the people were names that we probably don't know, but who I thought I wanted to elevate because I thought they illustrated a particular turning point in the history of conservation that was important. There's Rosalie Edge, who really convinced the early conservation movement that it was important to focus not just on charismatic species, but on all species, no matter if the people who were concerned with them personally found them appealing or not. She had a very prescient kind of sense of the ecological approach to conservation. And then there were figures who were famous in their time, but have since been forgotten, like William Hornaday, who was one of the early founders of the conservation movement, very important in protecting the American bison from extinction, but whose reputation, who was a very complicated figure in many ways, and who's not someone who's held up as an icon today, but who was very famous in his time.
Yeah. It's how was the process for you of uncovering, like, you know, as an individual who's been interested in this, I'm wondering, did you have preconceived notions? Did you already know, you know, these were the individuals that you wanted to focus on? Or was the process of digging through that history, like, really illuminating for you?
Well, both, all of the above, I think. I knew a fair amount about the history of conservation, or at least thought I knew a fair amount. And as I said, I did have certain people who I knew I wanted to include because they were so well known, even though I knew I might end up complicating their stories or showing some part of what they did that was less known. And then I did do extra work to find the right people to illustrate, as I said, the turning points that I wanted to show. For instance, the turning from a movement that was exclusively focused on North America and Europe to a movement that was much more internationally focused. I needed to find the right person to show that turn in the mid-20th century. And I found Julian Huxley, the brother of the novelist Aldous Huxley, who I had not known that much about before, but he turned out to be he was on the scene when that happened and was instrumental in it, and turned out to be a very fascinating, complicated fellow in his own right, and full of all kinds of contradictory ideas and very interesting to read about. So he was helpful in telling that part of the story. And then when I got to the present day, the movement gets more diffuse, and it wasn't as easy to find a single character to carry me through an era. So my chapters became more populated with multiple people, which was interesting in its own right. And often I ended up having characters, I often ended up having characters in conversation, so to speak, with one another, talking about conflicting ideas. For instance, Michael Soule, the founder of conservation biology in the 1980s, passed away while I was writing the book, as did Garth Owen Smith, who you may be familiar with from your time in Namibia, a very prominent conservationist in Namibia in the beginning of one of the founders of the community-based conservation movement in Namibia. The two of them both unfortunately passed away while I was working on the book. I had the opportunity to spend significant time with both of them, and I was able to put them a little bit in indirect conversation in the book, and I so wished that they had the chance to meet in person, because they had their values overlapped quite a bit. They were passionate about many of the same things, but their approaches to conservation were totally different. I think ultimately complementary, but very different perspectives. And I would have loved to have heard them argue it out over the campfire. But in lieu of that, my book was an effort to represent those different strains, those different philosophies in conservation as it's gotten closer to the present day, and to represent some of those decisions that still have to be made, those issues that are still unresolved.
You know, when I think about the kind of the whole timeline of the conservation movement, clearly what I have to grapple with here on the podcast is, when do we get meta? When do we talk about? And when are we telling the stories that are in the books through, this conversation that we're having right here? Obviously, what I don't like doing, and I don't like it when podcasts do this, is like tell the whole story of the book on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, well, read the book. It's going to be better. Like, trust me, like summer doing the book report is not as good. Yeah. So that's why I tend not to dive too much into the kind of big picture story. But I think that one of the things that's sort of maybe important, and one of the things that at least piques my interest, is this idea that conservation is not as easy or is not as straightforward as probably most of us who don't think about it often, if it's not a part of our job, if it's not a part of our personal sort of passionate initiative, we may not realize that good intentions often have terrible outcomes and vice versa.
Yeah.
Sometimes things that sound awful actually work. And so I'm wondering if maybe one of the things that we can do in the time that we have together today is highlight a few examples of sort of those counterintuitive lessons from conservation that you came across in doing your research and writing.
Sure. Well, One I can tell you right away, which is I almost feel like is a foundational fable of conservation, or should be, is the story of rescuing the American bison from extinction.
Okay.
Which was accomplished by, as I said, a very complicated man named William Hornaday. He was not the only savior of the bison, but he was an important one. He was a trophy hunter himself. He traveled the world supplying museums with specimens. He was a sport hunter. When he realized that the bison was going extinct, his paradoxical reaction was to rush out to Montana and shoot a couple of dozen of the last surviving bison, thinking he was going to preserve them for science.
Oh, gosh.
But I know. But one thing that he did that we know was helpful was that when he became director of the Bronx Zoo, he raised a herd of bison in the Bronx after a couple of, you know, cycles of trial and error. He had a thriving herd, and he in 1907, he put these animals on a train and shipped them out to Oklahoma and let them go. And there, that herd has now seeded several major federal herds, and is now, the descendants of those animals are now part of herds that are being returned to tribal and First Nations land throughout North America. And now Hornaday didn't care about the indigenous people of North America. He, in fact, blamed them unjustly for the decline of the bison. His ideas for protecting the bison were all sort of tangled up with his sense of nationalism, his sense of the threats to white masculinity at the time. It was thought that white men were sort of wilting away in offices and needed a dose of the frontier to, you know, stiffen their backbones. And so his motivations were very complicated. Some of the things he did may or may not have been helpful, but he did have enough foresight to realize that these animals needed to be preserved. And now, with the understanding that we have from ecology, that these animals are part of the prairie, they're not just, you know, livestock that should be let go on the landscape, and the leadership of tribes and First Nations who know that these animals are important, not just ecologically, but culturally, we can start to accomplish a much more full restoration of the species to the landscape. So to me, that story almost encapsulates the whole history of conservation, where people did, you know, they used the information that they had at the time. They were motivated by, you know, some genuine admiration or love for another form of life. Sometimes, as in Hornaday's case, they also had, you know, darker or what we would now consider really wrong-headed motivations. But their legacy has been something that later generations have been able to build on, sometimes in really exciting ways. And that's not to say the story of conservation is one of, you know, inevitable progress or anything like that, but there are partial successes that have been able to be extended. And I think we can continue to do that, which is one of the things I found so hopeful about learning about the history of conservation.
When I think about one of the things that's so complicated about conservation is that usually, not usually, but often, the motivating factor behind a person who's willing to really, you know, become a champion of an issue and dedicate a lot of their time and energy, which is what the movement really needs, is often motivated not so much by the concept or the idea of a thriving ecosystem, but of a, like you mentioned before, a charismatic species, or of, you know, or let's say a habitat. You know, I want to save these wetlands, or I'm seeing that the, you know, bison is being decimated, and I want to do what we can do to try and save the bison. And sometimes that's to the peril of other organisms or other ecosystems that, you know, are connected in this really complicated web. And so I'm wondering, as you were doing your research and you were writing, if you came across this kind of all too familiar story, especially historically, of times when the championing of one species or one specific, you know, focus kind of was to the detriment of others.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that is one thing that has changed over the history of the conservation movement that the conservationists are well aware of, but the general public, even people who are interested in conservation, tend not to be as aware of, which is partly the fault of the conservation movement itself. I think it did start out with people like William Hornaday, who admired a certain species, you know, had felt that they had a relationship with it for whatever reason, and really threw themselves into protecting that one species. But as the science of ecology grew up alongside the conservation movement, conservationists, well, you know, everybody has their favorite animal, but they became much more aware that they were in the business of protecting relationships, and that the species that they loved were part of these ecosystems, as you say, and that their job was to protect species, habitats, and ecosystems as a whole. But I think, and this is one thing I would love to see change, conservation organizations realize the power, the charismatic power of these animals that they want to protect from extinction, and they continue to use them as flagships and don't emphasize that their work is about protecting more than single species. So people will know about the panda or the bald eagle or the northern white rhino, but they'll have very little sense of how those species exist with others, or what kind of habitat they need, or you know, what kind of threats they face from the people who they share their habitats with. And I would love to see, and then I think the media of which I am a member tends to follow that lead and use, you know, photos of charismatic species to illustrate stories about conservation instead of trying to dig deeper into stories about relationships and stories about efforts of people to live within ecosystems. We tend to stick with very simplistic stories about single species going extinct, about efforts to protect certain places from humans instead of efforts to get people, you know, instead of efforts to help people live with species or with ecosystems. So yeah, I think the movement itself has gained a lot of sophistication, but I'm not sure that that is clear to the people outside of it, or even the people who support it.
I think you're right, you know, and it's interesting because so much does happen behind the scenes, so much messaging, so much kind of social psychology. And I'm reminded of, because I'm sitting here in my office in Los Angeles, looking at my bookshelf, which has a reproduced footprint and a stuffed animal of P22, our resident mountain lion that lives in Griffith Park. We have obviously a large population of mountain lions in Los Angeles. We're one of two cities on the planet that has a big cat, or that has big cats living within the city limits. It's LA and Mumbai. It's kind of amazing. Listeners may remember Beth Pratt, who I had on the show, who is the California director of the National Wildlife Federation. Yeah, National Wildlife Federation. And she, in some ways, I don't want to say single-handedly, but really led a movement to bring awareness to the plight of our puma population, you know, to really prevent them from going the way of the Florida panther. And connectivity is key. She's been able to raise a lot of money to build a wildlife corridor here in Los Angeles. But it's interesting because she gets blowback, and there is a complicated conversation around the fact that P22, our lonely bachelor in Griffith Park, has a name. People talk about him not having a girlfriend. There are trading cards for the cougars of LA. But at the same time, the idea of a wildlife corridor serves so much more than the cougars. It serves all of the animals that require connectivity in a city carved up by freeways. And so it's this complicated thing where, can I use this iconic species to then, you know, drag along conservation efforts for the species that people, no matter how many times you try to make a Western fence lizard look cute, you know, people just may not be that interested. And so much of it is tapping into the, it's like, what can we change? And where can we just, I don't know, use persuasion to our advantage?
Yeah, it is very complicated. And I know Beth, and I know the story of P22, and I think I admire the campaign, and I think it has done a good job of connecting the individual or this individual species with the larger picture of urban connectivity.
Right, but that's rare. But
it's rare.
Yeah.
It's very rare. And I think I'm sure it's taken a lot of intentional effort on her part and on the part of others to make sure that that connection doesn't get broken, you know, that the message is always carried by the ambassador, so to speak. I think, and I agree, there probably is something innate in us that's always going to feel more in common with other mammals than we do with, you know, fence lizards or fire ants or what have you. There are the few wonderful people who do care about, you know, ugly or dangerous or tiny species, but I think they're always going to be in the minority. I do think there's a lot to be done in telling the human stories of people who are living alongside really cool, complex ecosystems.
Absolutely.
I think and that's where I think I see the opportunity, because we, for so long, at least in the US media, I think have told the story of human sins against other species. You know, you can almost write a Mad Libs, like, people are driving this wonderful species extinct. If we don't stop doing X, you know, extinction is imminent. And there's very few handholds for people, for readers or consumers of that media to grab onto and say, oh, okay, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to support this project, or I'm going to participate in this or that. It's just, you know, stop doing what you're doing. Stop being so human.
Yeah. And like, also, like, there's so much guilt and shame
And so those can
avoid
be,
it.
They can be convenient motivators, but they're not, they shouldn't be the only motivators. And, you know, while at the same time, I think the environmental movement and the conservation movement, I mean, really need to connect with social science and with all the research that's done on how well people can share resources given the opportunity. I mean, some of that is being applied in Namibia with great success, and the conservation movement here in North America and to some extent in Europe is still stuck in this framework of, like, we have to protect species and habitats from humans, instead of how can we make it possible? Of course, we have to have parks and we have to have big reserves, but how can we make it possible for people to coexist with species and habitats in some sort of sustainable way? Because that's how we're going to protect all the incredible ecosystems that are never going to be protected by parks and reserves.
Yeah, that was my takeaway when I visited Namibia. We went to I'm going to try and pronounce it, but it's going to be terrible. The Kwaskwasi Reserve, which is a reserve that's like a land grant from the government where the indigenous populations collectively care for the reserve. And there are all these great initiatives to document sightings, document human-animal conflict. And when those documentations are made, there are incentives given back to the people in terms of, you know, whether they're financial incentives or protective incentives. So there's kind of a motivation to be shepherds of the land, to protect, you know, their livestock or to protect their water sources, but also to kind of, I think, build trust between the people and the government, that this is a cooperative effort. And it's been really cool to see the outcomes there, where people are able to live relatively harmoniously. I mean, obviously, human and animal conflict is always going to be an issue in a place where there are large predators, like Southern Africa. But to be able to figure out how to coexist in a way that there's a lion that's been stalking livestock, or there's an elephant that's been taking down fences, let's figure out how to approach this problem collectively instead of just killing the animal.
Yes. And the time I spent in Namibia in 2019 while I was researching the book was really eye-opening for me. And I had read about community-led conservation in principle, thought that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, let's see.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, seeing it in practice, it was really revelatory for me as someone who's thought they knew a lot about conservation, because it's this whole universe of possibilities that I think the conservation movement is starting to connect with, but still has not completely connected with it. And the results in Namibia, which they've now had this community-led conservation system, which is it's part of the national government now since the early 1990s, since Namibian independence. And the results are concrete in terms of, you know, rhino numbers and elephant numbers and the way they've been able to keep a lid on poaching, which is rampant throughout the continent. And then also the way that people have, it doesn't solve poverty, of course, but people have expanded their options for earning a livelihood. And I think most importantly, according to so many people that I talk to, there's a sense, there's the local authority for conservation has been restored after being broken by colonization many, many, many years ago.
And you see, so there's almost like conflicting, you see some triumphant stories, but some very sad and conflicting stories in very nearby countries like Botswana, where there have been like blanket bans on hunting that then had to be lifted because of overpopulation. And I think the problem is that it's complicated when we think about the fact that there are species that are endangered or species that are threatened. We think of them as being globally dispersed. And we don't often realize just because a species is endangered doesn't mean there might not be an overpopulation in this one region and then it's too thin in this other region. I think that also speaks to a larger conversation that Americans specifically, but definitely Westerners as a whole, hold, which is that there is developed land, and then there's wild. And this concept of wild, as if anything wild anymore on the planet isn't managed, I think is a very big misunderstanding that we Westerners have. Like, we literally think that everything's just roaming free without fences and that people have no idea what the numbers are like, when we don't realize that, no, almost all wildlife on this planet is well managed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. It's a very pernicious idea in many ways. Not to say that, you know, given that what we have done to many wildlife habitats, we do need large reserves. We do need large parks. We do need things that are meet the legal definition of wilderness. But to think of wilderness to hold in our heads this idea of wilderness as a place completely apart from us.
Yeah, that it's like fenceless and there are no people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just...
Yeah, and completely apart from human history, mm-hmm. I think is pretty counterproductive and leads to a lot of real harmful gaps and miscommunications between Western conservationists and African conservationists and people in other developing parts of the world, because, you know, as you say, these places are they have been lived in for millennia by human beings and in many cases managed by human beings.
They were the first places we lived.
Right. And then, you know, Western conservationists, in many cases, this is a big generalization, but many Western conservationists came to Africa in particular and saw it as a wilderness, you know, as an untouched place without a human history. And that was ultimately very destructive because they did break that connection between local people and the animals that they were successfully coexisting with. And it's taken initiatives like the community-led conservation effort in Namibia, which is one of many, by the way, not only in Africa, but around the world, to restore that authority and restore that sense of connection and responsibility that I think is so important if conservation is really going to be accomplished on a meaningful scale. So, and then there's just, as you say, there's just this lack of understanding and empathy. I remember being so struck and really horrified by a great project that the Washington Post did on elephants in Botswana and how the fact that there were a lot of elephants concentrated in a relatively small area was causing terrible problems for humans.
And for the actual, like, the ecosystem. I visited one of those national parks in Botswana, and it was scarred. I mean, the trees, mm-hmm. so many of the trees were down. There were too many elephants, and it was such a stress. I mean, it was amazing for me. I was like, look at all the elephants. This is amazing to see them up right. close. But, you know, you think there can't be this many large mammals in this small a space. It's not healthy for the species itself, and also for all the other species that have to coexist with it.
Exactly. And I mean, the ecosystem has suffered. People have lost loved ones to being trampled by elephants. They've lost crops, you know, which is devastating. But I remember when the Washington Post did this very good, you know, lavishly photographed story telling some of these personal stories, and they put it in context of, you know, the species being globally threatened, but overabundant in this one place. But the comments from North American readers were just incredibly callous, I thought, and really like, oh, well, you know, there's still more people than there are elephants.
Yeah, like they deserve to get trampled if they,
amazing. Not in so many words. And I think it speaks to this need for more complex thinking on every level, you know, that we need to see conservation problems as happening on many scales. I mean, yes, there is the scale of this species is globally rare and is deserving of concern, but then there's also what's happening on, you know, what's happening on the regional level, what's happening on the local level, what's happening with this individual household over here that's dealing with a rogue animal, you know, is we need to think of a solution for that. And we can't have these simplistic kind of fundamentalist positions of, you know, it's all or nothing, especially when we live thousands of miles away.
Again, it's like, until you're reflected, until you're confronted with books like yours, with conversations like these, and encouraged just to dig a little bit deeper and to push a little bit past our sort of initial truthiness, our gut reaction, I am empathetic to the idea that, like, well, that seems wrong. How could, because it's almost like a white guilt issue. It's like, we went in there and effed everything up. So why, you know, like, can we just fix it? Can we just like let sleeping dogs lie? Can we just walk away and let nature take its course? That seems to be almost the extreme reaction, which is, let's be honest, like 99.99% of the time, not the right reaction. You don't just walk away. You have to actively manage. It's the way that we know based on the science. And there are conflicts about how we manage, but just walking away is almost never the solution. Yet that seems to be this sort of uneducated, but I think very well-meaning mentality that we have oftentimes in the West.
Yeah. And what I trace it back to, at least in part, I trace it back to this idea of this real pessimism about human capability to play a constructive role.
Right. Like, whatever we do, we're going to F it up. So we should just wash our hands of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, God knows, I have a lot of sympathy for it. Yeah. You know, we all see evidence of it every day. And conservationists, especially, I think, you know, they're on the front lines of the worst that humans can do to the rest of life on the planet. But I think I trace it back to the idea of the tragedy of the commons, you know, which Garrett Hardin, an ecologist, proposed in 1968. It wasn't this idea that humans either, if you didn't have total privatization or total government control, that humans would automatically, if they had a shared resource, they would take individual advantage of it until the resource is gone. And, you know, we see the tragedy of the commons unfolding all the time in our personal lives, in traffic jams and what have you, but it's not inevitable. I mean, research has shown that there's so many ways for people to successfully share their resources. And that whole body of research, I think just the conservation movement has ignored it because the anecdotal evidence of the damage that humans do to shared resources is so strong. And that, you know, you can tell people 1,000 times, it's possible, you know, this is happening in Namibia. This is happening, you know, on many scales and in many places all over the world, but people find it hard. It's weird because it's such a pessimistic idea. You'd think that people would be delighted to let go of it, but it's simple, I guess. It's seductively simple. And so, and it's easier. It's in some ways easier to believe that all is lost, that there's no hope for humans. We just need to sort of abandon nature or wall it off or what have you, than it is to go through the very complicated, sometimes difficult work of learning to live with it, as people have done in Namibia. And it's taken them, you know, a couple of generations now to get that structure and those systems going to the point where they've been able to see real results, but they have succeeded. And I mean, I think it's something that we can all, you know, we in North America and Europe can learn a huge amount from.
You know what it almost reminds me of is, and I know there's a name for this phenomenon, but it's almost like the correction effect or the recall effect where, and we see it all the time in science communication and science journalism. Let's take Wakefield, for example. You know, we've talked about this a lot on the show, this idea that Andrew Wakefield fraudulently put forth data that claiming vaccines directly caused autism. It was debunked. All his papers were retracted. He became, you know, a mark on the scientific community. Yet people still believe, people still hold on hope, people still put a lot of effort into the initial claim, not the retraction. Even though the retraction is demonstrably true and the initial claim is demonstrably false. And we see this a lot in SciComm. It's like the first thing that's said, the shot heard around the world, is what people take to heart. And then even if you scream at the top of your lungs, no, wait, we were wrong. Let's look at how things actually are. And I wonder if there's almost a parallel there between like we effed up nature. That's the shot heard around the world. And now it's like, no, we've got all these awesome things that are really affecting change and fixing it. And people are like, meh. You know, like, I'm not really, that's not registering for me. Like, you're right. Yeah. It's like this pessimism we hold on to, but it's almost like that's the narrative that we laid down neuronal tracks for. And it's effort to undo those tracks now.
Yeah. I think there's probably a lot there. I mean, and early conservationists did use that to sound the alarm. They did say, look, you know, we've almost killed off the bison. We've almost killed off these beautiful birds for hats. You know, how ridiculous are we? We have to stop this. But, you know, I think that is, as you say, the neuronal tracks got laid down, and then, you know, theories or ideas like the tragedy of the commons gave it a fancy name or gave it a snappy name. You know, we had an easily understood box for it. And then the much more complicated reality, it's there. It's been well documented, but perhaps because it's more complicated, perhaps because it doesn't have a snappy title. There are probably a million reasons, but it does, even though it represents, you know, literally our own survival, it gets ignored in favor of this other previous story or existing story.
And it's a hard one to overcome. But of course, like we mentioned, these very human stories that are complex, nuanced, but also motivating and optimistic, I think this is the way forward. It's to learn about our relationship as human beings, not even our relationship to nature or with nature, because we are nature. Like, nature is us. We're not separate from it. And the more that we can kind of reinforce that narrative, I think the better off we're going to be for the long haul. And I think that your book really does, it fills a really important gap in our knowledge and helps bring a lot of these stories to light in a way that gives them their due and allows us to grapple with their nuance. And so, you know, I thank you for that. I thank you for sharing it with us and for doing that work. I'm wondering, Michelle, if you have the time, we always close the show by asking guests, I always talk about myself in like there's more than one of me. It's really weird. I close the show by asking my guests
You contain multitudes.
There you go. Thank you. Yes. And thank you, Ed. by asking my guests the same two questions, because I don't know, one day I'll do something with it, but I love to hear a multitude of opinions and ideas within these creative constraints of the same two questions. But before we mm-hmm. dive into that, I'm wondering, is there anything we didn't cover? Is there anything you think, okay, it's important that we get this out there with regards to the book or with regards to the work that you're doing now?
You know, I hope that people will recognize that the story of conservation is not a tragedy. Not necessarily a tragedy, though it does have tragedies in it. And a lot of people have approached me about this book and said, oh, I can't wait to read it, though I'm sure it's very sad. and I've thought, well, you know, thanks for your interest, but I hope it's not. It is sad in many ways, and it is daunting. You know, what we are facing is daunting, and I certainly don't want to diminish that, but I do feel that we have learned a lot. And as I've said, there are so many opportunities and so many really unexplored territories in how conservation gets done and how it could be done. So I hope people will find it uplifting or exciting in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. When you think about the future in whatever context is relevant for you right now, it could be in your next project that you've been working on. It could be something personal, something communal, something global, even something cosmic. Number one, what is the thing that's been keeping you up the most at night? The thing you're most concerned about, pessimistic about, maybe even cynical about. But on the flip side of that, question number two, what are you genuinely, authentically, and, you know, truly in your heart of hearts, optimistic about and looking forward to?
I would say what keeps me up at night is time, that we won't have time for whatever reason, because we reached one of the proverbial climate tipping points, or we reach some other point of no return, that we will have we won't have enough time to apply the lessons we've learned from history and from experience and from science. But I am genuinely hopeful about our capability as a species to do good for the rest of life on the planet. I think we have learned a lot about what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, given the chance, given the time, as I say, I think that we will lose species. We can't save everything. We're past that point, but we do have an opportunity to make up for some of our past mistakes and keep ourselves from making new ones and find a new, well, we combine old and new knowledge to find a better path toward coexistence with other species.
Yeah. Ugh. I think that inspirational but true, like that authentic message is one that we really do need to carry with us. It as we talked about, one of the main themes, you know, of today's conversation is that it's very easy to get stuck in the sort of pessimism of the difficulty around us. But when the other side of that exact same coin is this human ingenuity and this global spirit and so many things, I think so much change could be affected if we kind of learn to listen to each other more and to work together and is trending in that direction. Because I do think that the skill set is there and the almost the technologies are on, you know, are there, and even the know-how is there. And the real question is the will. It's the will and the capability, right? And we have it. We just have to tap into it. We have to agree with one another and tap into it.
Yeah, it's the will, and I think the structures that allow people to express their will. I mean, as going back to Namibia, I think that. The desire, I mean, once you get beyond politics, I don't think anyone would say that, you know, they would love to see their neighboring species go extinct, no matter how troublesome they happen to be. And so I think the desire to protect species is there. Sometimes there aren't structures and the opportunities to allow people to both make a living and shoulder the short-term costs of conservation, which there almost always are some. And there aren't structures allowing them to benefit from the long-term benefits. But when those structures are in place and the burdens and benefits are, you know, thanks to those structures are distributed more equitably, people do participate and they do, you know, they do express that will and act on it, you know, sometimes to really wonderful results.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for taking the time today, for sharing these wonderful stories, for introducing us all to beloved beasts fighting for life in an age of extinction. Everybody, make sure you pick up your copy. It's available today. We learned an awful lot, and it was a real pleasure, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.